Welcome to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas.
In looking at Cowboys of the Americas, the first thing I have in mind is both North and South America, and even including Canada as a part of North America. But the cowboy as an historical figure isn't a television personality or a rodeo rider. He's a working cowhand. Uh-huh. And so this book is about men who made a living herding cattle, trail driving, all of the things, always on horseback. That's an essential part of being a cowboy.
Now, as I understand it,
The West is still confronted with a lot of the issues that have to do with Aspen. That is to say, economic development, absentee capital coming in from the outside, the despoiling of the environment, the issue of the apportioning of natural resources. These are things that are still very central issues in the West today, and central issues that are concerning Western historians, too.
Did you write your book with an eye?
Cowboys of the Americas and Silver Mining in Aspen, Colorado, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for conversations with two historians, Richard Slatta of North Carolina State University and Malcolm Rohrbaugh of the University of Iowa. First, Richard Slatta talks about his new book, a volume entitled Cowboys of the Americas, recently published by Yale University Press. After that, Malcolm Rohrbaugh discusses his book entitled Aspen, The History of a Silver Mining Town, published by Oxford University Press. Richard Slatta's Cowboys of the Americas examines cowboys from their beginnings as wild cattle hunters to their decline in the early 20th century. The cowboys of the Americas ranged from the gauchos of the Argentine Pampas to the vaqueros of Mexico to the cattle drivers of the North American Southwest to Hawaii's pañolos. Richard Slatta.
Well, I think in a society that has often been described as having total amnesia, that is, we don't tend to remember historical things in our culture, it seemed to me that among the things that gets forgotten are the roots of many important elements of our society. In this case, we think of the cowboy in American history as popping up after the Civil War and then disappearing about 20 years later. Well, in point of fact, you need to go all the way back to Columbus's second voyage. You need to be in the 1500s as cowboys, cattle, and horses spread out of the Caribbean into all of South America, into Mexico, and thence up into North America.
So this is essentially a Spanish phenomenon that you were describing.
When one looks at open range ranching of the 19th century, at equipment used, at the manner of speech, the actual vocabulary of cowboying, at ranching technique, most of it comes up from Mexico. And therefore, when we talk about the American cowboy, who almost always appears as an Anglo-Saxon, John Wayne type character, we really have to remember that he learned virtually everything he knows from the Mexican vaquero, the cowboy of Mexico.
So the vaqueros and the gauchos of the Pampas of South America, they are the precedents for what we call our American cowboys.
Yes, very much so. The vaquero of Mexico is the direct antecedent to our cowboy, because much of early Texas ranching, for example, was done with Mexican cowboys until the Anglo influence came in and they learned to work from the Mexicans. In South America, Argentina, Uruguay, Chile, all of which have major cowboy cultures, there is no direct link between those cultures and the American West, but it's still interesting to look at and compare just how those subcultures developed, the attitudes of those men toward the range, toward animals, toward each other, what they did for fun, and we find some fascinating similarities popping up.
Well, let's talk about cowboy culture. We could put a number of words arbitrarily on the table, Rich Latta. Music, arts and crafts, food, rodeos, folklore. I take it that no one of these necessarily dominates in your book, Cowboys of the Americas. How do you organize your study?
Well, I try to depict the cowboy as he lived. That is to say, the environment. So there's a chapter on the nature of plains environments, what the Great Plains was like, what the Southern Pampas was like in Argentina,
right.
Just what was it as a natural environment. But then we go to work. So there's a chapter on work skills, on whether some cowboys, for example, downed wild bulls by grabbing them by the tail and toppling them over.
That would be Pecos Bill.
Well, that may have South American origins too, I'm not sure. Where was the lariat first used? How about branding and various parts of the work calendar? But cowboying was a seasonal occupation, and so they weren't working all the time. You find stretches, perhaps in some cases, 6-8 months at a time where they're unemployed. So they're looking for fun.
Well, let's talk about, use some academic language here, Rich Latta, the socio-political circumstances of the cowboy. I take it that we're talking about not the middle class, we're talking about the lower class in these North American societies. How is it that cowboys originate there and end up in some sort of classless myth that we've adopted?
Well, it's a fascinating process, Wayne, and one that's not limited, again, to the United States. The gaucho of Argentina goes through a similar transformation from sort of a low-class drifter who owns nothing more than maybe a horse to some kind of national symbol of virtue and virility. What we find in reality is that one simple variable separated people in frontier regions. And that's land. If you owned land, you were somebody. You were at least middle class and very likely upper class. Cowboys never owned land. So they're essentially migrant workers.
Was this a form of slavery? Could you go that far?
No. What's fascinating is that in economic terms, we're talking about very, very low-paid people here, people who have no upward mobility. But there are some things about cowboying that attracted certain kinds of people. I think there was a certain freedom. If you have a job, I know from the historical record that lots of cowboys told ranchers, you can take this job and shove it. They get on their horse and off they ride because they had that mobility. They weren't tied by property or anything else. It's clear that cowboys just like to be on horseback. And as long as you would let them do that, they would work hard for very little money.
What about women? In North America, we think of the calico queens, the soiled doves. There are lots of euphemisms here for women in the American frontier. In Latin America, on the other hand, you have the chinas of the gauchos, and they take on what a greater sense of respectability than the barmaids of the 19th century American West. Is it as simple as that kind of a contrast? What else do you do when you come to the topic of women and cowboys?
Well, one of the problems, Wayne, with looking at a figure like women on the frontier or looking at the cowboy, lots of the perceptions that are recorded come from outsiders with their own ethnocentrism and their own biases. One of my favorite tales was a British traveler of the 19th century to Argentina, and he looked at a gaucho family, having lunch, and he promptly decreed them barbarians because they did not use forks. that was his hallmark of civilization. The cattle frontier had proportionately fewer women than I think many other types of frontiers. The cowboys on the range cooked for themselves. They took care of their own personal needs. So we have even the extreme view of some ranchers that women are detrimental, that they're a danger because the cowboys will be distracted and maybe fight over them and so forth. When you did find women in cattle frontiers, they would be the wife of a rancher. And that put them in the upper class and made them untouchable. A cowboy would be too shy or reluctant even to say, howdy, ma'am, for the most part. In Argentina and Uruguay and Chile, you'd, I think, have more women in cattle frontier areas, but there's also this suspicion that they're kind of a dangerous force, this perception by ranchers. And they are also lower class, and because of the migration of cowboys going from ranch to ranch to work, there was very little chance for a real ongoing family life.
Mm-hmm. Apropos of that, Rich Ladd, I don't want to sensationalize the conversation, but what about gay cowboys? There is a phrase, the gay caballero. is it appropriate to look at that dimension of cowboy life?
Oh, I think what one wants to do with a highly romanticized figure like the cowboy is really try to look at every element of historical reality.
Rather than the macho heterosexual.
That's correct. Uh-huh. We have no reason to believe that there was any more or any less homosexuality in a cowboy population than in any other segment of population. And so from studies of other social groups, we know that certainly it existed. You might compound that with the very serious sexual imbalance in these frontiers. There simply weren't many women, and if they were, they were, as I indicated, either upper-class ranch women and untouchable, or probably prostitutes. Mm-hmm. Those would be the two largest groups. A distinguished Western historian by the name of Cliff Westermeyer caused quite a stir years ago when he first broached this topic of cowboy homosexuality.
You mean even the possibility?
Even the possibility.
Right.
And a lot of more traditional scholars came out with six guns blazing, believe me. But one of the problems is, Wayne, we have relatively few firsthand accounts from cowboys, diaries, things like that, where they might give us an honest rendering of their daily activity.
Well, many of them were illiterate, I take it, and therefore you do not have this documentation.
That's one of the big problems with doing any type of social history, and this is a work of social history, that is looking at those who have gone largely unrecognized or unnoticed in more traditional studies. The Latin American cowboys are virtually all illiterate. Surprisingly, American cowboys, by and large, were literate. We have lots of examples of them reading voraciously, anything from the labels on bean cans to scraps of newspaper that they picked up on the trail.
Mm-hmm.
What happens, though, is that the cowboy quickly becomes a popular figure in American culture. The dime beetle novels of the late 19th century, for example, Buffalo Bill's Wild West Show. So as cowboys are actually working the range, they already become aware of their own mythology. And so I think some of their... these created myths about them begin to appear in the writings by cowboys.
They want to perpetuate them themselves.
Well, and it sells.
Uh-huh.
Very popular.
What about the decline of the cowboy, the disappearance of the cowboy in terms of, well, we have a number of watersheds. I mean, we've got the Civil War for one thing. We've got World War I for another. We've got the rise of, just this large, wonderful word, industrialism in the United States. What happened to the cowboys?
Well, another problem with Western history is that it has often been looked at as a vacuum. That is, you've got the 98th parallel there, and you don't consider anything east of it if you're doing Western history. It's clear that the rise of industrialization, that the complex changes going on in the eastern United States are largely responsible for the rise of the cowboy, because that massive industrialization and urbanization creates the market for beef that Western ranchers meet. So ironically, the cowboy is both given a large livelihood by changes in the eastern United States and in Europe, a lot of exports, and it's those same kinds of forces that within about 20 years marginalize him and push him right off the range.
So we had really a very brief period of time when we can say legitimately that the cowboys were a cultural and an economic force in this country.
Yes, it's remarkably brief, Wayne. This period roughly from the end of the Civil War until some horrendous winters in 1885 and 86, mm-hmm. that's the heyday of open range ranching. And it was on the open range that large numbers of cowboys would be needed. once you get windmills, once you get fences, and certainly once you get mechanized vehicles,
railroads,
all of these things greatly diminish the demand for cowboys.
A footnote to our conversation, Rich Slatta. Again, your book is Cowboys of the Americas. Who's your favorite cowboy?
Well, without question and without shame, John Wayne Westerns are in a class by themselves.
I'm back in the saddle again, out where a friend is a friend, where the longhorn cattle feed on the lowly gypsum wheat. Back in the saddle again, riding the range once more, toting my old 44, where you sleep out every night and the only law is right. Back in the saddle again.
You're listening to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You've just heard a conversation with Richard Slatta, a professor of history at North Carolina State University. Richard Slatta's new book is entitled Cowboys of the Americas, available from Yale University Press. Slatta's book won top honors this year for nonfiction in the Western Heritage Awards competition, sponsored by the National Cowboy Hall of Fame. Soundings on Western themes continues. You'll hear next from Malcolm Rohrbaugh of the University of Iowa. Malcolm Rohrbaugh is the author of Aspen, The History of a Silver Mining Town, published by Oxford University Press. The mining of silver in Aspen, Colorado, flourished during a relatively brief period at the end of the 19th century. According to Malcolm Rohrbaugh, historians looked to Aspen for early models of how Americans responded to questions about the environment and the uses and abuses of absentee ownership. Malcolm Rohrbaugh.
Well, in the mining range that runs up and down through Aspen begins about 1880 and ends, say, in 1900. There were 7,000 mining claims in the immediate area of Aspen that were staked out. Of these, perhaps 50 at one time or another produced ore for profit, and five or six were enormously profitable, but you can see what the odds were.
Mm-hmm. Now, I take it that we have a handful of millionaires. Do we go so far as to say billionaires? And then we have lots and lots of people who worked hard who didn't necessarily come away rich. How about that?
Well, we're not talking billionaires, but we are talking millionaires at a time when there was no income tax.
When $1 million meant something.
When $1 million was really a significant sum.
Yeah.
And you have half a dozen of these people, and you have doing the work in the mines when Aspen is fully productive in 1890, 1891, perhaps as many as 2,500 miners working for day wages.
Now, we have a lot of myth, we have a lot of legend, we have a lot of romance that surrounds, I take it, Mac Rohrbaugh, a town like Aspen, and it's convenient or easy to categorize heroes and villains and hookers and one thing and another. Tell me about some of these social types that compose this mining town.
Well, you have entrepreneurs. Wherever there's money to be made, there are several different kinds of entrepreneurs. Uh-huh. So I would subdivide the entrepreneurs in Aspen into two groups, those with money and those without money. Those who came in and invested in a town, and those who were essentially self-promoters. And we have both kinds nicely displayed in Aspen. Among those who come in essentially without money and to make good are a man named Gillespie, who comes in and interests outside capital and ends up a millionaire. We have locals, H.B. Covenhoven and his clerk, D.R.C. Brown, who become millionaires by owning a store, and in exchange for goods, which the miners need, they take portions of mining claims and eventually strike it rich. And we have the great outside investors The most prominent of whom is Jerome B. Wheeler, who was a partner in Macy's department store.
We could talk about the environment. We could talk about natural resources. Let's stop there and just talk about those two for a moment. How does Aspen speak to us in terms of our environmental awareness today?
Well, Aspen, almost from the very beginning, was an interesting case study of problems with the environment. Silver mining in general, but silver mining is very wasteful in the environment.
Is it a dirty business?
Well, it's a dirty business, and it also demands enormous quantities of timber that are used to timber the mines. Mm-hmm. At the time that Aspen was being exploited as a mining area, the hillsides were totally denuded. They were all cut down, and the timber was used in the mines. Within a couple of years of the founding of the town in the early 1880s, newspaper editors were already saying that the Roaring Fork River, the beautiful Roaring Fork, was polluted. Mm. By sawmills and by mine tailings. Very early on, controversies over the environment surfaced.
And there was no EPA, no federal.
Oh, absolutely not. Uh-huh. Absolutely not. And it was nothing but local civic watchdog organizations, which took place very much a second backseat to the efforts to develop the town.
What about the interaction of cultural groups? This is something that we talked about before our taping session. You have white people, you have Indian people, you have Mexican people. How do you treat those issues in this book? How do they, in fact, speak to us today if we look back at Aspen as a as some sort of a historical precedent?
Well, you have two developments. One, I think, is the importation, essentially, of foreign workers, particularly Irish and German, to work in the mines. Mm-hmm. So you have separate cultural groups doing that. The second is that you have the traditional Western attitudes of hostility toward Indians and increasing hostility toward the Chinese.
And I take it that that hostility would extend, for example, to Irish or Italian or any of these outside groups that would come in. You got white yuppies way back there in the 1870s and 80s,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Well, the difference is, I guess, that these European groups, the Irish and the Italians, are recognized as people who do the work. Uh-huh. In other words, they're necessary. Whereas people like the Chinese and the Indians are seen as such a cultural threat and so alien that they are not permitted anywhere near, and it was an item of pride with Aspenites that Chinese were never permitted in the town.
How did they talk to one another about, how did they talk to themselves, how did they rationalize that? Didn't anybody come along and say, wait a minute, this is rank discrimination? Or was that just not part of the ethos in those days?
It was not part of the cultural baggage, and the Aspenites seized upon the riots which had taken place over Chinese labor in various other mining towns in Colorado as a justification for keeping them out. In other words, to allow Chinese in was to introduce the possibility of disorder.
Uh-huh. What about women? You've talked about class, and you've talked mm-hmm. about race. Women, I take it, were what, either the genteel cultural leaders, or there must have been an element of prostitution there. Describe that for me.
Well, there was clearly an entertainment industry that revolved around
sporting
life that revolved around prostitution, that it revolved around saloons in town, and there were particularly districts of the town that were associated with this, particularly Durant Avenue, this was something that. As Aspen matured, one of the signs of its maturity and prosperity is an attempt on the part of the city to clean up these various aspects. And Aspen is now not only a place to make money, it's a place for families to come and live. And so what has been something that has been accepted heretofore in the town must now be controlled and put back where people can't see it.
Mm-hmm. Were the mines, Mac Robop, safe places to work? When we talk about things like in the environment or natural resources, what about the safety of these men, I take it, principally not women, who worked in these mines?
The mines were not safe. They were very dangerous.
A lot of people killed there?
Many people killed, many people injured. There was a very active Aspen Miners Union. And the union was concerned not so much with setting wages and hours, although it tried to do this after 1893, for the most part unsuccessfully. It was concerned with providing support in case of injury, in case of death to the surviving families, and this sort of thing. And it was something that was recognized that mining was very dangerous. These people worked for $3 and a quarter a day.
Was that good? Was that bad in then contemporary money?
Well, in contemporary money, as mining went, this was about average. Uh-huh. But Aspen was considered a good place to work because the mines were prosperous and it was steady work. Mm-hmm. And it was not subject to cycles up until 1893, of course, when everything changed.
Mac Robaugh, again, your book is Aspen, the History of a Silver Mining Town. Why do you remember Aspen? Let me get personal here for a moment.
Well, I remember Aspen because when I was a young boy, I went to Aspen occasionally with my father. But it was only much later when I began to read a little bit on the history of the town that I came to understand that a historical study of Aspen could open up a window on all sorts of interesting issues that were alive in the last 20, 25 years of the 19th century that had to do with the West, that had to do with the people who went there, that had to do with the values that they carried with them, and the kinds of worlds that they attempted to make and the kinds of worlds that actually appeared.
Malcolm Rohrbaugh is a professor of history at the University of Iowa. Malcolm Rohrbaugh is the author of Aspen, the History of a Silver Mining Town, published by Oxford University Press. You're listening to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on the North American West is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 570. That's program number 570. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center is eager to hear your comments about Soundings.
You've been listening to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Next week, listen for two discussions about teaching and research in American undergraduate education. Wayne Pond will talk with Lynn Cheney of the National Endowment for the Humanities and Jane Tompkins of Duke University. Lynn Cheney will discuss Tyrannical Machines, her recent report to the Congress on teaching and research. Jane Tompkins will discuss her study of undergraduate education, a project she calls A Life in Class. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this program comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Cowboys of the Americas and Silver Mining in Colorado, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Richard Slatta discusses his new book, Cowboys of the Americas. Malcolm Rohrbaugh talks about his study, Aspen, the History of a Silver Mining Town. From cowboys to gauchos to 19th century questions about the environment, the economy, and land use, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.